This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Did you hear that? That's the sound of Local Bee. Get ready for a great selection of articles from several of the Metro's local magazines. One show with a wide variety of news about what's going on in and around Fort Wayne, from business to entertainment. It's Local Beat, right now on your audio reading service.
This is the Local Beat, and I'm your reader, Marcia. In our stack of local publications today, Fort Wayne Ink Spot, a new edition, sits on top. Volume 7, number 6, and the publication date was March 15th, 2024. That's where we'll start. We'll read a little something out of the Giving Guide, a resource to the region's philanthropic opportunities. Business People, our March edition, will come third, and then we'll wrap up today in Fort Wayne Magazine, March 2024. Let's get started. Fort Wayne Ink Spot. We'll start with the cover story entitled The Dyer Grant Program, here to support and take the journey with Black-owned businesses. This is written by La Christelle Brown, Fort Wayne Ink Spot contributing writer. The Dyer Family Foundation has generously supported leaders and nonprofits over the years, which has made a great impact in the areas that Tammy and Jack Dyer felt passionate about. The Dyer Family Foundation was founded by Tammy and Jack Dyer in 2001. Jack and Tammy have raised their family in the city of Fort Wayne since 1973, and they have taken on various volunteer roles throughout the years. The Dyer Family Foundation's mission is to provide financial support to small businesses and entrepreneurs in the Fort Wayne market. The Dyer Grant Program was developed and geared to support Black-owned businesses. The Dyer team is hopeful that the grant funds will provide working capital to qualifying applicants. Joe Jordan and Eric Headley birthed the Dyer Grant Program for Black-owned businesses under the Dyer Family Foundation umbrella. Jack and Tammy Dyer had an unfeigned desire to support the African-American community in a purposeful way, and Jordan and Headley brought this desire to life by developing a vision, bridge, and vehicle for the support to be given to African-American business owners, according to Tamara Headley, the Director of Administration. Tamara Headley joined the Dyer team because she loves the hearts of Jack and Tammy Dyer for innumerable reasons, but specifically because of how they demonstrate their love for others and their community. They haven't been gratified with merely providing grant dollars to Black-owned businesses, but they also take the time to build sincere relationships with many of the grant recipients. Headley says that within the first few months of the program's developmental stages, she was asked to provide administrative assistance to the team, which then turned into her role being more centered on directing the operations and grant processes. The Dyer's hearts, kindness, generosity, gentle spirits, and Headley's love of the work she does are the reasons that she enjoys working with the Dyer Family Foundation. The Dyer Grant Program's purpose is to help for-profit small businesses in key markets of Greater Fort Wayne with financial support in amounts of up to $25,000 based on program guidelines. Business requirements include, number one, business with annual revenue of no more than $1 million. Two, business must be in existence a year or longer. Three, if a business owner operates more than one business, only one application to a single business owner will be accepted. Number four, the name on the application must match the records with the state, county, and city. Five, businesses must supply a certificate of good standing. Six, the business must have a business address within the Greater Fort Wayne Allen County geographic area. Number seven, grants funded must be utilized towards any capital expenses that improve the business, such as day-to-day business expenses, rent, working capital, payroll, utility bills, or losses due to destabilizing events, which would include any capital improvements. Number eight, agree to share financials and other essential information. Number nine, agree to share changes in the business as a result of the grant funding. And finally, number 10, agree to participate in business-enhancing programs offered by Dyer Grant Program and its partners. The Dyer Family Foundation team includes the founders Tammy and Jack, Chuck Surak of Surak Enterprises, Eric Headley of Surak Enterprises, Joe Jordan of the Boys and Girls Club, Lafayette Jordan of Indiana Black Expo Fort Wayne Chapter, and Tamara Headley. During the grant process season, the team comes together to look through every application to learn if the applicants meet the program's requirements and fit into their pillars of focus. After those steps, the team then uses their best discernment and collective experience to decide which businesses make it to their final round, which then determines the businesses that they personally visit to see them in action, according to Headley. The Dyer Grant Program has awarded grant dollars to almost 30 Black-owned businesses with a total of over $300,000 in grant dollars awarded over the past 2 years. There's been a vast compass of Black-owned businesses that have received dollars. Some of the professions include optical landscaping, fitness, artistic creations, and 13 child care facilities over the past 2 grant cycles. Headley says that Tammy and Jack have special hearts for the African-American community and want to journey with these businesses as they work towards continuous success. The Dyer Grant Program is accepting applications until March 20th, 2024. To apply, visit their website, Dyer, D-Y-E-R, familyfoundation.com/apply2024. When asked what advice she has for someone who may be interested in starting a foundation that gives grants, Headley expressed that there are several extraordinary foundations in Allen County that contribute meaningful resources that result in amazing work being done. The Dyer Family Foundation is happy to be a small foundation with one program that is specifically centered on one mission. Headley's only advice for anyone or group aspiring to start any effort that would support others is to stay focused on your mission. She says there are always great needs within our community and beyond, and the temptation to meet every need comes from a great place, but focus and discipline helps us all to make an impact in our specific lanes. The Dyer team is not currently accepting applications for employment. If you'd like to reach out to the Dyer Family Foundation with questions or for more information, you can email them at contact@Dyer, D-Y-E-R, familyfoundation.com. Dyer team is grateful for the opportunity to partner with some of the most innovative, talented, and persevering leaders in the community, the Black-owned business owners. We will continue on in Fort Wayne Ink Spot with a couple more articles. The next one is written by Betty Miller Buttram, Fort Wayne Ink Spot contributing writer. The headlines read, In Touch with Good Teaching. In this political season of super primaries and the State of the Union address, I recall learning about the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government that is composed of three distinct branches, the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. I was a student of Mr. William Simon during my 7th, 8th, and 9th grade years. He was my homeroom teacher for all 3 years. I remember that he always stood at the door of his classroom making sure that all his homeroom students were accounted for in the morning and during dismissal in the afternoon. Those were his administrative duties. His homeroom students would see him at assigned periods for his class during the day throughout the school year. He was a teacher of American history and civic education. When it came to American history, he drilled into us about the Constitution and a lot of teaching on the function of the three branches of the U.S. government. The legislative branch is made up of the Senate and House of Representatives, called Congress. The role of Congress is to draft proposed laws, confirm or reject federal judges and judges to the Supreme Court, and has the authority to declare war. The executive branch is the U.S. President, Vice President, and Cabinet members, approved by the Senate. The judicial branch includes the Supreme Court and other federal courts. This branch interprets the law, applies the law, and decides if any laws violate the Constitution. The class was quiet as we tried to process this information into our young brains. This was a 7th grade class, and we had just left elementary school. Mr. Simon stated that if we did not understand what was being taught, that is why there are such things as questions. No questions were asked because we were still in process mode. Mr. Simon kept on teaching. His most precious assignment to his students was reading the daily newspapers, the weekly and monthly magazines. He called this part of civic education current events. He would have us read an article and tell what it was all about in our own words. He had us reading newspapers and comprehending what we read. Some of us had a different article when it was time to report, and some of us would read about continuing articles that were capturing public attention. These articles became special projects for some of the students. I decided to read, write, and report about the Little Rock 9 students in Arkansas. My special project took a while because of the turbulence it was causing. Mr. Simon guided and taught us about the growth of America from the landing of the Pilgrims, the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, Emancipation Proclamation, and all that came after, that making up the history as it was back in my day. He kept on teaching us about our civic duties and keeping up with current events, and then it was time for high school. During my 10th, 11th, and 12th grade years, I attended a small all-girls high school with an enrollment of 200 students. We were of different cultural backgrounds, white, black, Hispanic, Latino, with about 15 to 18 students per class. In 10th grade, we had a teacher named Miss Cecile Akey, who taught social studies, which included civic education. There it was again, that study of the many structures of government and the procedures within those structures. Miss Akey's focus was on voting rights and how powerful it was for a citizen to have that right. It was September and the general election was in November. In 1960, John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon engaged in four historic debates that were televised for the first time and became American history. Miss Akey wanted us to understand the Constitution and the three branches of the government. Again, there was the reading of newspapers and other published information about the candidates. We questioned Miss Akey about why we were doing this because Washington, D.C. was not a state, had no representation in Congress, and had three commissioners who controlled the district government. The D.C. residents had no voting rights. She told us that one day we might be living in a state with voting rights like Maryland or Virginia, and that we needed to know how to vote and to educate ourselves about the voting system. This became a school project for the next 2 months because Miss Akey had declared that the school would have its own election day as part of the learning process. The student body and the teachers were on board the voting train. The entire school population of 200 students campaigned within the school for their candidates. The school cafeteria became the voting place. The students cast their votes on election day morning. The teachers did the vote counting. The students went home to watch the general election play out on the television, for that was their assignment. The winner of the school general election was announced the next school day, the day after the general election. Some were disappointed that their candidate did not win, but it had been a good teaching lesson. Mr. William Simon went on later to become the president of the Washington, D.C. Teachers Union. Ms. Cecile Akey retired a few years after her voting students graduated. When the general election, state, county, and local elections come around, I am always mindful of the teachings of Mr. Simon and Ms. Akey. History is always a learning process, and voting will always be a powerful tool. And the last column we'll read in Fort Wayne Ink Spot today, it's written by Reverend Christopher W. Riley, Fort Wayne Ink Spot contributing writer. The headlines read, On the Summit's Horizon, Community Blood Drive Raises Sickle Cell Awareness. Timothy Lyman only lived to be 17 years of age. He lost his battle with sickle cell anemia in 1983. However, he continues to make an impact over 40 years after he walked this earth. Lyman would have been 58 years old on February 28th. The Timothy Lyman Sickle Cell Foundation held a blood drive on Saturday, February 24th at True Love Baptist Church, 715 East Wallace Street. True Love's pastor, Reverend Robert Bell, was one of the first to donate. The men of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, Inc., Theta Upsilon Lambda Chapter, TUL, volunteered at the event. John Key, chapter president, shared, Alpha Phi Alpha prides itself on a willingness to support the community. It's no secret that blood donations are down, and when given the opportunity to support such a worthy event, the brothers of TUL gladly jumped in to provide assistance where necessary. It's our goal to further develop this partnership going forward. We appreciate the opportunity. According to Change for SCD, and online, changeforsCD.com, one in 365 newborn Black Americans will have sickle cell disease. 1 in 13 newborn Black Americans will carry the sickle cell trait, and 1 in 16,300 newborn Hispanic Americans will have SCD. SCD is an inherited lifelong disease that presents a wide range of disease severity, including acute and chronic complications, widespread organ damage, and the risk of early mortality. Despite the wintry weather of Saturday morning, we were able to make a dent in the need for blood to aid sickle cell patients, said Beverly Lyman, executive director of the Timothy Lyman Sickle Cell Foundation and older sister of the deceased Lyman. We were able to collect approximately 24 units of blood that will potentially help 72 people. Every one person who donates blood can potentially help three people. Our goal was 58. Praise God, we surpassed our goal. The blood drive was facilitated by Versiti of Indianapolis, which has been in existence since 1952. Versiti Blood Center of Indiana supplies blood services, blood products, and specialty services to more than 80 hospitals across the state and collects more than 130,000 units of blood annually. In addition to the men of Alpha, the National Honor Society of Snyder High School, which was where the late Timothy Lyman attended, also volunteered at the blood drive. Everybody is lovely. Feels like a small community of family. It was great volunteering and helping those in need, said Snyder Senior Braylon Charlton. Lyman shared that the following businesses supported the event: Trader Joe's, Mission Ribs, Pizza Hut, Starbucks, Fresh Market of Coventry, and Community Harvest Food Bank. The African American Healthcare Alliance also co-sponsored the event and is a huge supporter of the foundation. We could not have had a successful event without the community coming together, said Lyman. Okay, next up is our giving guide, a resource to the region's philanthropic opportunities. We'll read about a couple organizations. The first is Center for Nonviolence. About us. We are a nationally recognized multilingual, award-winning leader in violence prevention, intervention, and support and advocacy. Our trauma-informed, client-centered, and culturally affirming services are designed to meet each client's unique needs, empower them in their healing journey, and create a sense of safety and belonging. By focusing our services around the principles of respect, empathy, and cultural inclusivity, we have the ability to facilitate the process of healing, enhance resilience, and contribute to the overall well-being of individuals affected by violence. Our programs. Intervention. This educational program is for everyone, family, friends, neighbors, and community members who are struggling with their use of interpersonal violence or have caused harm to others. Prevention. Curricula and activities for youth that promote self-reflection, problem-solving, decision-making, compassionate, and personal accountability while undermining the social norms that fuel domestic violence in our community. Support and advocacy. Culturally affirming, trauma-informed support groups paired with one-on-one advocacy for victims and survivors of domestic and other forms of violence. And finally, community engagement. Trainings, workshops, and topic-driven education sessions for groups, organizations, and businesses wishing to create nonviolent and inclusive community spaces. Giving opportunities. When you invest, you help keep our services free for domestic violence survivors and their families who need support. Here's how you can make a difference. Become a peace partner. Set your monthly donation to the amount that works best for you. Text to give CFN to 44321. Online, Center for NV, the initials NV for nonviolence.org/donate. On Facebook, create your own fundraising page and raise awareness of our cause. Facebook.com/fund/Center for Nonviolence FW. And there are corporate partnerships for companies looking for ways to give back and create more equitable communities. We would love to hear from you. They're physically located at 235 Creighton Avenue in Fort Wayne, 46807. Center for NV, the initials NV.org. Email give@centerfornv.org. Coronary panel and board of directors, Amalawe Kito Aloduwa, Lormikia Warren, Inez Oldenburg, Maureen Carruthers, Emmanuel Ortiz, Antoinette Payne, and Linda Troop. Executive directorship, Kalila Hannon, Elka Jackson, Juan Navarro, Tasha Sayre, and Dawn Witte. Our impact, over 1,000 families receive our resources and support in Northeast Indiana. Our second organization today, Matthew 25 Health and Care, their mission. Matthew 25 is inspired by the gospel to provide free primary health care services to uninsured, low-income residents in Northeast Indiana and Northwest Ohio. The history. For over 47 years, Matthew 25 Health and Care has provided high-quality medical, dental, vision, mental health, specialty care, educational, and medication services at no charge to low-income, uninsured individuals in our community. We offer hope to the most vulnerable population, treating them with compassion and dignity regardless of background or beliefs. Services. Matthew 25 provides patients with access to over 25 specialty care clinics, 30 key dental services, mental health counseling, health, nutrition, and diabetic education, eyeglasses, vaccines, medications, and supplies at no cost. Giving opportunities. Matthew 25 receives no government funding. We are supported solely by donations, grants, and foundations. And volunteer. Many of our clinics are run 100% by volunteer medical and dental professionals. We rely on volunteers to operate. Prescriptions filled, 31,137. Medical visits, 22,300. Dental visits, 4,559. Eyeglasses, 232. Physically, they're located at 413 East Jefferson Boulevard in downtown Fort Wayne, 46802. Online, Matthew 25, the numeral 25, online, spelled out, .org. Facebook, Matthew 25 Clinic. And Instagram, M25 Free Clinic. The CEO is Michelle Krager, CPA, Hope, Health, and Healing. Okay, next in our stack is Business People. This is our March 2024 edition. The first article we'll read is in the profile section. The headlines read, Beyond Ordinary Banking. With relationship building at the core of its foundation, Horizon Bank offers one-on-one white glove service to its clients. The article is written by Heather Heron. All the services available at a big bank, but with personalized attention. Simply put, that's what customers get at Horizon Bank. Founded more than 150 years ago in Michigan City, Indiana, it now has locations stretching from southern Indiana to Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Despite the growth, Horizon has stayed true to its small-town roots and remains a community bank. I know the term community bank gets thrown around as a catchphrase, but people value being able to go in and talk to the person that's making the decision, explains Chris Books, the assistant vice president, branch manager in Fort Wayne. They're not being put through to a call center. There isn't a firewall of people that you have to fight through. You're going to get answers, and you're always going to have direct contact with someone. Frank Gomez, the assistant vice president, commercial loan officer in Fort Wayne, says that's just one advantage of using a community bank. Another benefit is the experience and expertise each team member provides. Because of our size, we are so in tune and close to one another, and it allows us to get answers for ourselves very quickly, but ultimately those answers are impacting our clients, he says. Though Horizon Bank isn't as big as a nationwide institution, it offers the same resources, tools, products, and services like convenient online banking, checking and savings accounts, mortgages and commercial loans, and wealth management and investments. One differentiator is a concierge white glove approach to each customer's experience. We have the capacity to provide those services, but we're able to provide them from a community perspective, the focus being serving the communities as best we can, stresses Books. That intentional focus is made possible because decisions are made by people who live in the communities they serve. That's not only evident in the Horizon team's one-on-one interactions, but is especially seen in their commitment to helping local businesses thrive, which benefits the entire region. The underwriting process allows me to be very connected with the client and really understand their financials, their historical performance, and what the future looks like, says Gomez. That really puts the client in the best position possible. It's not an automated application system that gives you a yes or no. We have the capacity to lend out multi-million dollar requests as well, but we're able to make these decisions locally. We're really looking at clients and the request for credit as an investment in the community. While Gomez handles commercial loans and Books is responsible for retail operations, both believe that Horizon's emphasis on forming relationships with customers is key to the bank's success. Always top of mind is their unwavering commitment to doing the right thing for clients. They can pick up the phone and call us knowing who they're going to speak with. Someone is always going to have their back and will take care of them. It's as simple as that, said Books. We're not transactional. It's not simply, I need a loan and then, okay, here it is. We're not order takers. It's not just the customer cashing a check or making a deposit. We talk to the customer and uncover a need they might not even know they have. It's an approach that inevitably always seems to exceed a customer's expectation. That's the goal. Horizon Bank's main office is at 110 West Main Street, Suite 100 in Fort Wayne, 46802. The initial B, Diller, D-I-L-L-E-R, at horizonbank.com. Website, horizonbank.com. Fort Wayne Market President is Brooks Diller. The next column we'll read in our March edition of Business People is Four Questions With. And the focus this month is on George Guy, CEO, Executive Director, Fort Wayne Housing Authority. Here's the introduction before the four questions. George Guy loves his family, his job, and helping those around him. As CEO and Executive Director of the Fort Wayne Housing Authority, FWHA, the largest affordable housing provider in the city, Guy stays busy. His passion for FWHA's mission is evident, and he and his team strive to continue pushing the needle forward for safe, quality, affordable housing for all. We chatted with Guy about what led him to FWHA, the impactful work being done through the organization, and learned a bit about his life outside of working hours, too. Question one, tell us about your background and what path led you to Fort Wayne Housing Authority. And he replies, prior to FWHA, I spent 15 years working in community development, education, and workforce industries, including being a high school athletic coach. Before coming to Fort Wayne, I was the director of operations at Rock Island Housing Authority in Illinois. After several years of doing transformative development and program building, I decided that I wanted to leverage my skills and experience to assist in another community. After looking at different opportunities, I came across a position at the Fort Wayne Housing Authority. Fort Wayne was interesting to me because it appeared to be a place where agencies collaborate on solutions for individuals who have been marginalized. I was successful in that pursuit and began as the Deputy Executive Director in 2009. And as part of a succession plan, I was to become the CEO Executive Director after 2 years. Second question, what does FWHA do? And he replies, Fort Wayne Housing Authority is the largest affordable housing provider in our city. It serves 3,797 families and 8,425 total family members. With the Housing Choice Voucher Program, HCVP, previously known as Section 8, we provide almost $20 million in rental investment income to local property management companies and landlords. FWHA owns, manages over 1,000 properties throughout the city. The units include housing for the chronically homeless, those aging out of foster care, and single-parent families. FWHA also administers Emergency Solutions Grants, ESG, from the city and the state to provide housing and supportive services for those who are homeless or are at risk of becoming homeless. We also offer our families pathways to self-sufficiency through our Enrichment and Career Services Department, which focuses on employment, training, education, and home ownership. In addition to the work that we do in Fort Wayne, FWHA also manages the Decatur Housing Authority. Our team is very passionate about the work and the services we provide. We're proud to say that we are recognized as a learning and training center for housing professionals nationwide. We have also been recognized locally, regionally, and nationally by earning over 60 awards for our developments and supportive services. Question 3, walk us through a day in the life of George Guy. And he replies, I generally get up at 4 a.m., mix up a green veggie drink, and meditate. Afterwards, I work out, and that's where the fun begins, post-workout. I'm usually assisting in getting the kids around and dropped off at school. Then it's off to work. My days usually consist of morning check-ins with our team to see where they need my support, and then meetings continue throughout the day. There's the occasional fire or two, but we have a really great team in place that handles issues as they arise. So those are few and far between. Although the day starts early, it's filled with opportunities that encourage and excite me for the next day. I love what I do and the team that I work with, so it doesn't really feel like work. And finally, the fourth question, what do you enjoy doing in your free time? George Guy replies, family is incredibly important to me. I'm intentional about spending quality time with my wife, Crystal, our three daughters and three sons. I participate in school functions and activities and am a volunteer coach. I'm a person that believes in self-care, so I try to commit time to invest in my wellness by reading, working out, meditating, etc. I also make sure to step away from work to spend time with not just my immediate family, but my extended family as well. Being intentional about the time I spend with my family and making them a priority allows me the ability to reset. And that is George Guy. And we will finish the magazine. Again, it's Business People, March 2024. And we'll wrap it up with one last article. Pro Speak is the section, and it's workplace design. The headlines read, Transforming Workplaces for Employee Mental Health. It's written by Lauren Elliott, Director of Interior Design, Design Collaborative. Renovating your workplace can have a profound impact on the mental health and well-being of your employees. By creating a supportive and positive environment, you can foster a sense of belonging and promote overall mental wellness. Here are a few practical tips and strategies to renovate your workplace with a focus on improving mental health. Introducing natural elements such as plants, sunlight, and green spaces can have a calming effect on employees. Add indoor plants, large windows for natural light, or create outdoor areas where employees can relax. A well-designed workplace should offer a balance between collaboration and privacy. Create open spaces for teamwork and brainstorming, as well as quiet areas for focused work or private conversations. Encourage movement within the workplace. Incorporate standing desks, ergonomic furniture, and designated areas for exercise or stretching. Promoting a physically active environment can improve mood and overall well-being. Ensure there are resources and support for mental health. This can include designated spaces for relaxation or meditation, access to counseling services, or implementing policies that promote work-life balance and stress management. Create spaces that encourage social interactions and a sense of community among employees. This can include communal areas for breaks or shared meals, team-building activities, or organizing events that promote collaboration and connection. By prioritizing the mental health of your employees through workplace renovation, you not only create a healthier and happier work environment, but also foster increased productivity and employee satisfaction. Remember, small changes can make a big difference. Invest in your employees' well-being and you will reap the benefits of a thriving and resilient workforce. And that wraps up Business People, March 2024. And that brings us to our last publication today, Fort Wayne Magazine, March 2024. We will start with Jennifer Dodds Fox monthly column, Fashionably Speaking, and the spotlight is on Charles Shepherd. Charles Shepherd grew up in the shipyard town of Bath, Maine. He worked after school in a men's clothing store owned by his father and grandfather, where he was taught how to sell anything and how to buy what he was selling for 10 cents on the dollar. In high school, Shepherd began experimenting with his sartorial choices, making art and drumming for rock bands. After graduation, he landed at the University of Maine, followed by grad school at Williams College and a stint as executive director of the Ann Arbor Art Fair. 4 years later, his alma mater hired him to teach art history and to transform the University Art Gallery into the University of Maine Museum of Art. From there, Shepherd spent time as the executive director of the not-yet-built Kennedy Museum of American Art, then as executive director of Connecticut College's the Lyman Allen Art Museum, as well as their professor of art history. In 2003, he was appointed executive director of the Fort Wayne Museum of Art. He has since acquired thousands of pieces for the flourishing organization's permanent collection. Shepherd spearheaded the sparkling new glass wing, featuring more than 400 pieces and counting. It is one of the fastest growing collections of studio glass in the Midwest, according to the Fort Wayne Museum of Art website. Shepherd lives in the city with his wife Amanda and their two children. The museum's annual shindig, the Artrageous Gala and Auction, takes place on March 1st and is one of the city's most lively and glittering events each spring. So then it's a question-answer column. Choose three words to describe your personal style, and he replies, casually classic, sailboat chic. What do you wear to work? He said, on a daily basis, I'm moving things around in the galleries, going to meetings, giving presentations, and talking to our donors and collectors. I need to look presentable, but I place a high value on feeling comfortable. In warmer months, it's shorts and golf shirts, while in colder months, it's jeans and a blazer. He's going to finish the sentence for, I can't leave home without my, and he said, my new remarkable tablet that holds all my notes, multiple to-do lists, harebrained project possibilities, and contact info. Best book you've ever read? He said, 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, a magical story about the lives of Bendia family in the mythical town of Macondo. Best line from a TV show or movie? He replies, my favorite comes from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. When the Black Knight, John Cleese, gets his arm cut off by his adversary and mutters, it's only a flesh wound. How do you arrange your bookshelves? And he said, by topic, just to be practical. Then I don't have to search the cookbook shelves for my dog-eared copy of Stephen King's The Shining from 1977. Current favorite podcast? He replies, my favorite recently is Frit City, a glass podcast from the Museum of Glass in Tacoma, Washington. I've learned so much. What's your most treasured escape? And he says, heading to Traverse City with Amanda and the kids as often as possible. On a daily basis, I hop on the Peloton and think about my next glass project. One item that's made your life better? And he replies, I just discovered the joy of having an electric griddle. Pancakes and bacon breakfasts are suddenly so simple. What style item did you dream of owning when you were a child? Shepherd replies, a dark blue, double-breasted blazer with shiny brass buttons to wear over light tan khakis or pale blue frayed jeans. Whose style do you admire? And he replies, drummer Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones, a Savile Rose best advertisement, but I lean more to David Beckham's look. Then there's Daniel Craig, soccer player Sun Heung-min for Ralph Lauren's Wimbledon look, and the musician The Weeknd. Best gift you've been given? He said, this Christmas, Amanda painted a painting for me of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph on an articulated wood panel that is absolutely beautiful. Visually, it's a tour de force, but it's all the more amazing that with all the personal and professional things on our plates this year, she made the time to create this painting for me. Best bet you've given? Charles Shepherd replies, a couple years ago, I gave Amanda a large oval, highly detailed wall relief of Mary and Jesus carved in white meerschaum for Christmas. It is old, rare, and very beautiful. That was a special gift indeed, but Amanda might tell you her favorite gift was the high-end road bike that I got for her when she shifted from competitive volleyball to serious biking. Next question, what's the first thing you notice about someone's outfit? And Shepherd replies, my job is all about looking at things and making aesthetic judgments about how their colors, lines, and forms interact to make an impression. So I end up doing much the same with everyone I encounter. That said, the very first thing I notice is how what they're wearing sets up the presentation of their face. In the 1968 film Bullet, actor Steve McQueen stands in an open doorway in black slacks and a black turtleneck that highlights his square-jawed, serious face. By contrast, Blippi, the children's show host, uses orange suspenders, a matching bow tie, huge yellow glasses, and a floppy beret to give his face the effect of youthful innocence and naivete. When I run into anyone, I guess I'm looking at how well their outfit enhances the presentation of their face. If you could dance with anyone from history, who would you choose and what would be the song? And he said, without a doubt, I would choose Fly Girl, Jossie Harris Thacker, who danced in Janet Jackson's troupe in the 90s. We danced to Mary J. Blige's Real Love, just like she did on Soul Train. I learned to dance watching that show. Intimate dinner party with friends or Wild Rager? He said, definitely an intimate dinner with a few friends, preferably outdoors by the fire pit in warm weather. If you could jump into any Olympic sport and be really good, which would you choose? And he said, karate for sure. I've watched every Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan movie ever made and spent hours privately trying to learn their moves. Three more questions. What's an embarrassing style moment you can laugh at now? Shepherd says, well, here are a few. The winter that I wore a black Kangol cap backwards everywhere trying to look like a beat poet. Or the 2 years I sported a super big David Crosby mustache that totally covered my mouth. Or the summer I grew my then blonde hair down past my shoulders and topped it off with a knit sky blue skull cap and wore a ratty blue terry cloth bathrobe over a pair of surf trunks everywhere. I drove an old purple shag-lined VW bus around like that for months. What is your strutting down the street song? And he said, AC/DC's Back in Black. And finally, your favorite spot in Fort Wayne? Charles Shepherd replies, there are so many great spots in Fort Wayne there that are on my favorites list. But high on my list is the Friendly Fox, where I have breakfast almost every Saturday morning with my 7-year-old daughter. And that is Charles Shepherd. We will continue on in Fort Wayne Magazine. And the cover story is entitled Renewal. It was started a couple weeks ago, so it's broken down into sections. Renewal was the first section. Reflux was the second, and that brings us to Refresh. And this is written by Mary Kiura, Assistant Professor of Organizational Communication, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. And then there's a quote that begins the column, growth. One of my students told me, she was feeling trapped in her work and studies. Her expressions reflected a lack of confidence in her abilities. What struck me was her consistent use of language reflecting a fixed mindset, such as, I'm not clever anymore, I'm not talented like my colleagues at work, or some students are natural at certain tasks. She admitted to questioning her readiness for the job market once she graduated. A lot of her fears were rooted in the pattern of being praised for her intelligence rather than hard work and effort. This led her to develop a firm belief that talents and skills are innate and fixed from birth. Embracing a growth mindset means believing that intelligence, abilities, and talents can always be developed through dedication, effort, and resilience. This perspective can truly facilitate change by reshaping how we perceive and, consequently, respond to life challenges. After listening to my students' self-sabotaging stories, I knew it was time to introduce her to the concept of growth mindset. Together, we embarked on a journey of her self-discovery. We prioritized reframing her perception of feedback from her boss and instructor, shifting it from viewing it as an attack on her character to correction of the behavior. We worked toward her adoption of a new perspective on mistakes, viewing them as opportunities for learning rather than as permanent obstacles. Additionally, we stopped seeing success as something that should come naturally, but rather as a byproduct of effort. We also endeavored to let go of the need to look smart at all costs and replaced it with wanting to learn at all costs. Let's set the record straight. These changes were not a straight road or an overnight fix. Rather, cultivating a growth mindset requires self-reflexivity. It demands critical interrogation of our inner landscapes, our thoughts, beliefs, actions, strengths, aspirations, and it compels us to adapt accordingly. Self-reflexivity, which can be accomplished through practicing such as journaling, empowers individuals to take ownership and control of their lives and identify areas of growth. As my student's mindset shifted, her confidence and resilience grew in tandem. She began to step out of her comfort zone, engaging in challenging activities she would have previously avoided, as they would not make her look smart. With each completed task, her confidence blossomed. Her journey is just one of the many examples of the transformative power of growth mindset. It's a reminder that our beliefs about our abilities shape our reality more than external factors. Indeed, we can unlock our full potential by embracing a growth mindset and going after our dreams and aspirations. I've been privileged to witness similar transformations of many students over the years. From shy freshmen navigating the new challenges of a college life to graduating seniors preparing to embark on their next chapter. Clichés often contain truths that we shouldn't overlook, and that is certainly the case with this one. The only constant is change. Change should not be seen merely as a process that is bound to happen, but as a profound journey of self-discovery and growth that is always happening. This extends beyond the acquisition of knowledge. It requires adopting a growth mindset and engaging in self-reflexivity. I hope we all strive to embrace that transformative mindset. Everyone deserves to thrive. The next section of our cover story is written by Rachel Blakeman, and its theme is reprocess. Here's her introduction. Prepared. We all have to eat. For most of us, it's a choice of convenience, cost, nutrition, and flavor. As for me, I'm a serious home cook, usually trying more than 100 new and different recipes in a year. So change and renewal are part of my kitchen and my healthy food choices. Or are they? Last summer, I read Ultra Processed People: Why Do We All Eat Stuff That Isn't Food and Why Can't We Stop? By Chris Van Tulken. It explored the dominant role of ultra-processed food in the Western diet. While reading the book, I decided that I would accept the challenge of changing my eating habits and give up UPF in January. My goal was to see what role it played in my own diet, as well as how I handled real change. Here's how I did it and what I learned from 31 days of eating foods that look similar to the options my great-grandparents would have had 100-plus years ago. What constitutes UPF? To give up UPF, I first had to decide what constituted ultra-processed food. While it's obvious that frozen chicken fingers and breakfast cereals with artificial flavors and colors are UPF, what about things like cheese or bagged salad mixes? This is where the NOVA food classification system came into play. Developed by Brazilian researchers at the University of Sao Paulo in 2009, NOVA breaks foods into four groups. Unprocessed or minimally processed foods are just what they sound like. Think foods like eggs, cow's milk, and fresh fruit, or even dried beans or frozen vegetables. Processed culinary ingredients are foods used for seasoning or cooking other foods such as butter, sugar, dried herbs, ground spices, plus salt, vinegars, and oils. process foods in the Nova system combine foods from the first two food categories into new food products like cheese, some baked goods, canned beans or canned vegetables, or even things like salsa. To be ultra-processed, the minimally or unprocessed food becomes transformed by using commercial additives and industrial processes to alter taste, texture, and color, usually making it very appealing to our most basic senses. For this project, I decided not to eat anything that contained ingredients that I couldn't find in a residential kitchen, which in turn became a month of label reading. And yes, I understand that I don't have things like vitamin D and iodine at the ready, but as a matter of simplicity, I didn't object to nutrition-based additives. Reading food labels, if I wasn't going to eat anything that I couldn't find in my kitchen, I had to read ingredient labels religiously. I'm already familiar with the federal food label and its nutrition information, but since I don't have any significant food allergies, I was not used to reading the ingredients in every food that was going to touch my lips. What I quickly learned was, yes, so much of my food was ultra-processed under the Nova system, despite my own efforts to eat healthy foods. Great example, canned, diced tomatoes that have calcium chloride. Making changes. With my newfound love of label reading, I discovered not all food is made the same. For example, my plain old bottle of ketchup in my fridge had high fructose corn syrup, so I bought the organic version, which was made with sugar. My basic cottage cheese had texture-focused additives, so I went to a specialty grocery store to look at their organic cottage cheese, and boom, some same additives as the stuff I already had. Yet a trip to a traditional grocery store produced a national brand with cottage cheese made solely from milk and cream. I couldn't find canned chickpeas without an additive to preserve the color, so I learned how to rehydrate dried chickpeas. Notably, many of the purer options came with a higher cost than their ultra-processed version, which means households with cost constraints on groceries, especially in an era of inflation and higher food costs, may find that cutting back on UPF will not fit their budget. I also noticed that imported items often had no additives, unlike their American counterparts. But that was not universally true, as a Japanese wasabi I bought had thickeners. Some foods I just gave up entirely that month. Mayonnaise, I'm looking at you. I know I can make it pretty easily at home in my food processor, but it wasn't worth it for 31 days. So much cooking. Those who follow me on Instagram know that I love to cook, but this month really tested my resolve here. In ordinary times, I do a lot of my own cooking, but I also supplement that with things like bagged salads, frozen prepared foods, and other food that doesn't require me to do a lot of planning ahead. What am I having to eat? Without relying on ultra-processed food to fill in the gaps, tell me you have an emergency frozen pizza in your freezer too, I had to plan out what I was going to eat every day. This project required me to have cooked or otherwise prepared nearly every food I ate. No opening a bag from the freezer with a ready-to-eat option when I get home from work. A saving grace, microwave nachos consisting of tortilla chips, shredded cheddar cheese that I shredded because shredded cheese from a bag has additives, and jarred salsa. I had many bowls of air pop popcorn with butter and salt. I also made a lot of no-knead bread to have at the ready for avocado toast. I did discover a few new recipes I really liked and made some old favorites like the TikTok famous baked feta pasta. Another staple was roasted vegetables, which I never get tired of. Already looking forward to the next round of roasted Brussels sprouts and cauliflower. And in case you share my love of pizza, you can make it at home, UPF free, so long as you make the dough and sauce from scratch and grate the cheese at home. I love naturally and artificially flavored beverages, namely flavored coffee that I make as a cold brew and canned sparkling water, not to mention fun flavored teas, which are a must on cold January mornings. Since natural flavors are often synthetically produced, I avoided all added flavors. I adjusted to unflavored options fairly quickly. It was only a month, but that first sip of my mint mocha cold brew coffee in February was amazing. I'm going to stop the column there. We will finish it next week, but I see we are out of time for today. I've enjoyed spending this time together with you. This has been Marcia with The Local Beat. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.